Unless you have been in a sensory deprivation unit, you cannot have missed the controversy caused by the publication of 12 cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. Now, the debate in a lot of the Western world has focused around the issue of freedom of speech. The argument is that blasphemy is protected in secular Western societies under free speech laws, and that Muslims, whether in Muslim countries or as immigrants to the West, must accept that these values are fundamental, non-negotiable components of Western civilization. But anyone who's been watching European politics over the last few years will see this argument as a tad simplistic. Muslim immigration has been a polarising issue in Europe for much longer than it has here in Australia, and it cannot be untangled from the publication of these cartoons. And let me say at this point, I'm glad I'm working in the wireless, because we're not confronted by the ethical issue of whether or not we should show them to you, because, of course, we can't. In the last few months, several Dutch towns have introduced laws banning the women from wearing the burqa. A German state has brought in a citizenship quiz known as the Muslim Test, which asks potential settlers about their attitudes to, well, girls' swimming lessons, homosexuality. September the 11th. And you'll remember the huge controversy in France last year over the ban of girls wearing hijabs in state schools. And then we'll get down to this claim of free speech made by the Danish editor in Jyllands Posten, the paper that published the cartoons. It seems he was not quite as committed to free speech and challenging religious orthodoxy as he claims, because in April 2003, he refused to print cartoon caricatures of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The reason? I don't think our readers will be amused, he said. I think it will cause an uproar. Now, joining me to discuss this is Jutta Clausen, who's a professor of political science at Brandeis University, and she's got a book on the subject called The Islamic Challenge, Politics and Religion in Western Europe, published by Oxford University Press. Jutta, welcome to LNL, and thank you so very much for taking our call. I know how hard you are at work on a deadline, and we're very grateful to have your perspective, because as well as being a political science professor and specialist on Muslims in Europe, you're ordained. So can you tell us a bit about the political context of the publication of these cartoons, which of course emerged in a right-wing Christian paper?
It is. It's a paper that historically has belonged to the party of the government. It is a conservative paper, a provincial paper, and it actually was my family's newspaper. I grew up reading this paper every day.
When you say your family's, you mean you were on the receiving end of it, not that you owned it.
No, that's correct. Okay. We had a subscription. I grew up in the Danish farmland, so...
How did the publication of the cartoons play out in Denmark when they were first released? Was there much of a reaction?
There was a number of protests. They came from very different sides. There were some people, other journalists and some legal professors, who said that the paper had overstepped the bounds for what was permitted in terms of free speech. Denmark, in fact, does have blasphemy protection for what's called a recognized religious community. The criminal codes, Article 140, provides for up to 4 months of prison for deriding a recognized faith.
So if I was to have a go at the Bible, I could be in big trouble in your country.
You could. It hasn't been much applied. There was a Danish artist who wanted to do a movie, a fairly pornographic movie about Jesus, and he was given a grant in 1973, and then the grant was yanked, and he had to wait until 1989 before he actually got the grant restored after much difficulty with the police and court system, etc.
So it's a bit like the blasphemy laws in Australia or the UK, very, very infrequently brought into play.
That's right.
I should point out that when I talk about when the cartoons were first published, we're talking last September, aren't we?
Yes, they were published on September 30th. And it was clear immediately that there was going to be quite a reaction in Danish debate. Muslims protested that they were demeaning and anti-Muslim. One of them shows a man with the Prophet as a man with a bomb in his turban, and the face on, that's drawn on the Prophet is that of a radical imam, well-known radical, a much disliked imam in Copenhagen.
So let me clarify this. So we're not just talking about a representation of Muhammad. It's, if you like, a double whammy. There's a particular Danish Muslim character.
Yes, yes.
And, but that's not widely comprehended, is it?
No, I don't think people have seen that because they just see the picture of the face. And much of the public debate has really been about just drawing pictures of the Prophet. And Danish debates were not much about that. It was about the character of the cartoon. Some of them, by the way, were quite funny, actually.
Mm. Okay, you argue that the Danish Prime Minister might have headed all this off if he'd sat down and talked to various Muslim representatives who asked to meet him.
Yes, he was asked for a meeting already in October and refused to meet with 11 ambassadors stationed in Copenhagen. And that was not well received by the diplomatic community in general, because it is standard practice that when ambassadors come with a request to meet with the government, you meet with them.
Well, can you explain why he didn't? Do you have any real understanding of this odd decision?
Well, I would say that it's pretty clearly the case that he thought it would be to his political advantage to not be seen as weak-knee towards Muslims. It is a minority government, and the government depends on its majority for the support from the Danish People's Party, a vehemently anti-Muslim party.
Your country has a long and, I think, justifiably proud tradition of being at least comparatively tolerant. Do you find it deeply shocking that you're now the focus of world concerns?
I am not personally shocked, because I thought that the fall from grace was long overdue. But many of my friends are very shocked and are not quite sure what to think about it, because it's very frightening to see these angry faces saying that Denmark should be taken off the map.
Mm. Denmark is, like Australia, a member of the coalition of the willing in Iraq.
Yes. Yes.
And clearly we've been watching your politics take a significant, not yours, your country's politics, take a significant turn to the right in recent years. How much of that is reaction to immigration?
Oh, it is almost wholly reaction to immigration. One of the interesting issues is that a lot of people are actually not happy with the European Union, but both the center and the center right and the center left support integration. So much of the dissatisfaction about the European Union and integration is displaced into an anger of everything foreign and immigrants, and that is the one issue that the Danish People's Party has very successfully mobilised on.
As I'm sure you're aware, we haven't had a great wave of immigrants from the Muslim world, but we've had a couple of thousand people arrive over 20 years as refugees, and that's been enough to create a sort of a populist backlash in this country. And so we're both in a similar situation of discovering within our national psyches things that perhaps we wish weren't there. What about the question of so-called Danish values and Danish identity? Is that much discussed?
There has been a real effort to restore Christianity as part of Danish identity. Danes have, contrary to their reputation, in fact, always been quite loyal to the Lutheran Church and do get married and christened and buried by the Church in great numbers. But increasingly, Danes are also actually admitting that they believe in God. And even the Queen has said that it is important to restore Christian values as an effective counterpoint to the influx of new religions. And that if Danes go on just being lukewarm Christians, they will be overrun, is the story.
We're very fortunate in Australia to have Her Majesty the Queen as our head of state. And, of course, she's also the head of the Church of England. Is there a similar sort of alliance between church and state in your country?
Yeah, it is in the Constitution that the Lutheran Church is the Danish state church, is the people's church. Danes often think of it as not the state church. No, no, they will say, they will protest. It's the people's church, but it's fully financed over the tax bill, and it's mandatory that the Queen or the King, who will be Crown Prince, who will be next, who is married to an Australian, by the way, so she will be the next Queen of Denmark. And she did have to convert in order to marry, by the way. It is in the Constitution that the royalty must be members of the church.
I live in a country which, like yours, everyone ticks, or most people tick, Christian, one of the denominations, when they're filling out the census form. But this is a fairly agnostic society. It's a bit like the UK, where not that many people rush off to church on Sundays. We don't have the same level of intensity as one observes, say, in George Bush's America. But do you think this dynamic is going to change that in your country?
No, I really do not think so. I think Danes will remain fairly lazy Christians, but I think it is a particular strand of nationalism that absorbs these kind of politicized religions, and I think that it's not just Muslims who politicize religion, but Christians do too.
We've talked a lot with the local Muslim leaders in Australia over other issues. And, of course, most Muslims are not too happy about the wilder manifestations of religious fervour. I suppose that's the same in your country?
Yes, it is. One character in this dramatic story is this very unpopular radical cleric whose face was superimposed on the prophet, and he was the one who took a bunch of cartoons around for a visit to Cairo and Qatar and showed them off in order to stir up trouble. The anger against him is extraordinary, and some very, very nasty things are being said about him, including an effort to get him extradited from the country. He is originally a political refugee from Morocco and does not speak Danish, in fact. And does not have Danish citizenship, so now the Danish People's Party wants to throw him out of the country.
So you're sitting on a number of powder kegs, aren't you? How does Denmark compare with the rest of Europe when it comes to the issue of Muslim immigrants? You know, on the spectrum, where do you sit?
It's pretty bad. it really couldn't get much worse, actually. Things are quite bad also in the Netherlands, but I would say that there's been for some time a much more open debate and about the issue, and it is not just populists who are holding on in the papers, but in Denmark it's really, one good thing that has come out of this is that Danes are beginning to be more willing to examine themselves. But that has been a long time in coming.
I guess France is the least tolerant, Britain the most. In the Netherlands, there are some Muslim MPs.
Yeah.
And there's a ban on wearing the burqa, isn't there, in some Dutch towns?
Yes, some Dutch cities, municipalities, now provide for a fine if you wear the burqa on the streets. It's like you have a parking fine or you have a burqa fine.
I don't want to overstate it, but some people characterize the role of Muslims in European society at this moment with that of the Jews from the Middle Ages to the 20th century.
Yes, I get very uncomfortable with that comparison, because what usually is argued next is that the Holocaust will follow. I personally have for a couple of years compared the situation to the United States, say 1960, before the Civil Rights Movement. There's a great deal of misunderstanding, mischaracterization, fear, and there are also real issues about legal and economic and political equity.
As you know, Australia's had some recent race riots between Muslim and Anglo, gangs at least, and to a large extent they were, in my view, well, not so much fomented, but certainly encouraged by irresponsible elements in the media. We have US-style shock jocks here. Do you have them as well?
Yes, and certainly the decision to publish these cartoons was very much a sales ploy. There are three things that sells newspapers in Denmark, and it's sports, naked girls, and bashing Muslims. And this particular paper, since it's a conservative family paper, does not print naked girls. So it has only sports.
Oh, dear. So it's stuck with that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so the big question at the moment, or the way it's being cast, and I promise I'll stop interrogating you, is this controversy an issue of free speech in secular democracies, or is it that so-called clash of civilizations between Christian Europe, Christian everywhere, and Islam?
Well, a lot of people really would like to make it into a clash of civilizations. And that is what the editor of the newspaper writes on his op-ed pages. He compares himself to Salman Rushdie and thinks that's what's going on, and only Christians tolerate free speech. But the reality of things is that Muslim leaders in Western Europe are telling the Islamic countries to stay out of this. And most moderates do not think that there is a generalized prohibition on making fun of Islam, or that there can be no cartoons printed. A Danish imam, Fatih Alev, who preaches in Danish and is a moderate, was speaking at several meetings over the weekend saying, let's forget about the cartoons. That's not what the issue is now. We need to stop digging ditches and get a dialogue.
Well, I think they're lucky to have you around, sort of making sense and talking quietly, but I guess a lot of your fellow country persons are now living in dread of what happens next.
Yes, I think Danes have been really spoiled because of the myth of the good Dane, the Danes who rescued the Jews, but it wasn't all Danes who rescued the Jews, and it's not all Danes who are anti-Muslim xenophobes, but generally speaking, it is rough right now in international organizations to be a Dane, and many Danes are really frightened. A poor Dutch photographer was beaten up in Beirut because the crowd thought he was Danish. Mm. And it is going to be a big change for Danes to suddenly have to walk uphill all the time.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Jutta Clausen is Professor of Political Science at Brandeis University, and her very interesting book on the subject is called The Islamic Challenge, Politics and Religion in Western Europe, and it's published by Oxford University Press, and this is a little wireless program. It's called LNL. It's on Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and, of course, downloadable into your or onto your iPod, your MP3 player. Last night, in our last exciting episode, you might recall I spoke to Jutta Clausen, who's Professor of Political Science at Brandeis University in Boston, about how those cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad, and also a local Islamist, were more than just a free speech issue. In the context of Danish politics, they're clearly aimed at a broader political debate, a populist debate about Muslim immigration versus Danish or Christian values. It was interesting to learn that the cartoons were published in a right-wing Christian paper, and the editor who currently trumpets his rights to speak freely and to publish freely only 2 years ago declined to publish cartoons of Jesus because he thought they might offend the readership. Tonight we're going to talk to Robert Fisk, the Middle East correspondent for the Independent newspaper, for his take on this burning issue. And of course I use the word advisedly. Robert, in one of your pieces for the Independent, you described last Monday's rioting in Lebanon as perhaps the worst day since the ex-Prime Minister was assassinated on February the 14th last year. Can you tell us what's been going on?
Yeah, well, what happened was that Muslim demonstrators who were known by the government to be about to protest turned up outside the Danish consulate here in Beirut and proceeded not just to try and burn the consulate, which they failed to do. Actually, they burned a lot of buildings, but not the a lot of businesses, but not the consulate, but also attacked a Christian Maronite church and then went on to confront police outside the foreign ministry. It became a sectarian issue. And, of course, in Lebanon, where we live on this thin crust of sectarianism, where Muslims and Christians constantly announce that they love each other desperately, but actually are very suspicious of each other and very worried about each other, this is really, you know, like living on top of a petrol can. And the great danger was that, you know, that the whole issue of these preposterous cartoons in this pipsqueak newspaper would suddenly set off the whole sectarian problem of Lebanon again. That, you know, the ghosts of the civil war lie in their mass graves here, and we always wonder when they're going to climb out, as we did when ex-premier Rafik Hariri was murdered on the 14th of February last year, almost a year ago, and as I did, of course, when I, you know, when this fighting took place in a Christian area of Beirut, because the Danish consulate, by chance or mischance, if you like, was is located in a Christian area of Beirut. And suddenly we had, of course, the justice minister, who happens to be a Christian, Charles Rezek, saying correctly, what have the people of Ashrafieh, i.e. the Christians, got to do with cartoons published in Copenhagen? But it was a very dangerous moment. 2,000 Lebanese troops were deployed. Most Lebanese soldiers are Muslims, I should add, which is a fact, although they don't talk about it here, to prevent this rioting, and did so successfully. They managed to avoid killing a single person. So there were no martyrs to the cause, so to speak. But it was a very dangerous moment. Today, I mean, I'm talking to you literally from Beirut as I speak, a cold, wet, blustery winter's day. Most Lebanese have actually put this behind them. They don't care about it anymore. It's something that's gone past. So I don't think, despite the fact that Europe might do so, that the whole issue of the cartoons is, you know, is burning up the entire Middle East.
But Bob,
enormous problem for all kinds of reasons.
Bob, you however make the point that regional rioting shows how quickly nationalist Arab governments can be challenged by Islamists within their own countries.
Yeah, well, you see, the problem, excuse me, has always been that we, the West, have supported the various dictators of the Middle East. And we have supported them when they wanted emergency laws to prevent gatherings of opposition movements, i.e. subversives. And this means that the only place where the opposition could meet in freedom was the mosque. And they did meet in the mosque. And so we, in our support for these various dictators, whether it be Nasser or Sadat, or whether it be Saddam, as it was for a long time, Hussein, or King Abdullah, King Hussein of Jordan, etc., we produced a society in which the only opposition could be within religion. And suddenly, not only has that opposition become concrete, but we've suddenly announced we want democracy in the Middle East, and all this opposition is showing itself as it is, as being Islamist. Thus we have the Hamas victory in, quote, Palestine, unquote. Thus we have the Iranian Shiite victory in Iraq. Thus we have the clerical victory in the Iranian elections, and so on and so forth. And thus we have this huge showing of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. What the whole issue of the cartoons shows is not that some pipsqueak newspaper can publish ridiculous cartoons. It's that Muslims live Islam. They live their religion. We do not. We Westerners, you and me, well, I don't know about you, but certainly me, we lost our faith in the Victorian age. You know, that wonderful line from Matthew Arnold, "The sea's long withdrawing roar." Our faith died away. We became secularists. We became locked onto human rights, which is not a bad thing to be. I'd far prefer to be a secularist. Thank you very much. But we've got to acknowledge the fact that Muslims, through all their historical vicissitudes, have kept their faith. And for them to have a cartoon which says that the man who brought them the divine word from God himself, as they believe, is some kind of suicidal, violent man is an appalling attack. Had, for example, the cartoon pictured a rabbi with something in his headdress showing a bomb, we would all have been accusing this newspaper, rightly so, of being anti-Semitic. But when the same newspaper produces a picture of the Prophet Muhammad with a turban with a bomb inside, we all cry, free speech, free speech, free speech, secularism. It's outrageous.
Okay, so the debate in much of the Western world, which focuses around the issue of freedom of speech, is to you not only tenuous but hypocritical. And both of us can remember any number of instances when Christians, individually or collectively or in terms of voluble members of this or that hierarchy, have gone ballistic over films which even quietly criticise or raise issues about Jesus.
Just over 10 years ago, I was in Paris and I went to see a movie called The Last Testament of Christ, which showed Jesus having sex with a woman. I thought it was a pretty third-rate movie, I had to say, but a few weeks earlier, another movie house, another cinema in Paris, showing the same film, had been burned to the ground and a young Frenchman had been killed in the cinema. And I can give you a personal example that in Austin, Texas, I'll now name the university, Austin, Texas, I'd gone to give a lecture in the United States about the aftermath of the September 11th, 2001 crimes against humanity. And the title of my lecture was September 9/11, I put it in the American sense, right, American phraseology. And I said, ask who did it, but for God's sakes, don't ask why. It was my old question, right? You know, you need to, what happened in the Middle East produces. And the university said to me, as I arrived, that they'd taken the phrase, for God's sakes, out of the title in case it upset sensibilities in the region of Texas. You know, in other words, I mean, you know, you and I can say on an Australian radio show, you know, for God's sake, what are we talking about? But in Texas, you can't say that unless you upset people. And who knows what they'll do if they're upset, you see. So it's there.
Bob, after last night's discussion with Jutta Clausen, which I thought was immensely valuable, I got an email from one of the listeners. Let me quote a couple of fragments. Any person with European heritage lives on the basis of 1,000-plus years of their forebears giving their blood to get the priests out of our daily lives and establishing governance systems that give access to power to just plain folks. There is no appetite for such goals, and certainly not the cost in Islam, nor in the hearts of any but a very, very few Muslim individuals. And he goes on to say, I'm afraid that the truth is this. The do-gooders who say, let's all live in harmony, Muslims are just like us, are handing our secular society back to religious people who have no such belief that living in harmony with all comers is the bedrock for a preferred society. How do you respond to that?
Well, I've got to a point where I'm so bored of this discussion about the cartoons that I'm, you know, my mind reels at the thought of another discussion on the same subject. But I see the point. Look, I've said this to you before, I think, Philip. I'm sitting in my apartment in Beirut. My landlord, who lives two floors below me, is a Druze. My driver, whom I've just sent home for the day because I've done all my interviews for the morning, is a Sunni. My fixer here is a Shiite. And I have many Christian friends, as every Lebanese will tell you, but I do. In fact, I'm having dinner with one this evening. And I simply live in a totally homogenous society. I actually live in the Muslim part of Beirut. It is divided. It has been ever since the war, and it was really before. So most of the people I live among, including my maid, who has just come and started cooking my lunch for me, which is going to be a pizza, by the way, they're all Muslims. And I don't feel at all in any form different from them. I don't even think about their religion. When it is their religious holidays, I congratulate them in the same way as you would perhaps say Happy Christmas to me at December 25th. And they say to me, by the way, on December 25th. So there is simply no, for me, living in a Muslim society, which I do, I simply don't feel or think about the difference. Now, you can say to me, or your blogger or whatever, or your email writer can say to you, well, you know, they won't accept, they won't accept, they won't accept. All the Muslims I work among and with, and whom I must work among and with, because I live here, they are very careful always to remember my birthday, Easter, Christmas. Not because actually, I too, like all the Victorians, I've lost my faith. I don't necessarily believe that, you know, Jesus existed. I think he probably did as a historical figure. But the fact of the matter is, they say Happy Christmas to me, Happy Easter, and I always, and when, you know, when it is the breaking of the fast during Ramadan, I go and I join them for coffee and sweets and so on. And I don't like the sweets, I do like the coffee. There you go, as they say. But I don't think it's a big deal. But, you know, when people try to make, let's go back to this issue of the cartoons, which is why we're talking on the telephone today. When people try to make provocative issues, they can do it. There's no doubt they can do it. You can go through the Bible and find all kinds of reasons why massacres in the Old Testament would justify ethnic cleansing, genocide, Holocaust, whatever you like. We have to have a basis of humanity in which we deal with our, you know, fellow humans. There's a wonderful quotation, allegedly, to Ali, who was, of course, one of the great Shiite leaders, who said, if you see another man, these were the misogynist days when women weren't acknowledged, but you can change it, if you see another man or a woman, they are either your brother or your sister in religion, or they are your brother or sister in humanity. I've changed it. The original did not have a sister involved. But the fact remains that that's the case. When I drive around this country of Lebanon, which is more than half Muslim, it's about 34% Christian, I can usually tell from the town I'm in, the village I'm in, whether it has a church with a cross or whether it has a mosque in, with of course, the half moon above the minaret. I simply don't care. And nor do the people who are talking to me what my religion is. We know, of course we know, everybody knows. You know, still here, with the exception of the middle classes, Christians and Muslims do not intermarry. Unfortunately, I think they should be able to. If they want to intermarry, they have to go to Cyprus and intermarry at a registry office. They can't do so. A Christian cannot marry at a mosque, and a Muslim woman or man cannot marry at a church. But the fact remains is that in this country, with all its 150,000 dead from 16-year civil war, 1975 to 1990, you carry on and you get on the same bus. I mean, there's a number 5 bus route outside my house that carries Christians and Muslims, and we don't think about it. Why is it? Here's a question for you, Philip. Why is it in Australia or Europe, and I've just been in Denmark and Paris and Dublin, why is it that in the West, quote, West, unquote, these issues are so burning? But when I get on the number 5 bus outside my house, and I know a lot of people, actually normally I have my driver to be very swank and British, and I have my newspaper's driver here, but I do take the bus. Why is it that the people on the bus whom I know and who are of different, you know, they're Muslim or they're Druze or they're, which is, of course, a branch of the Muslim religion, or Christian. We don't care who we are. We say, when I ask them, you know, how is your kid and is your family okay and did your father get over his heart attack, et cetera, et cetera. And we treat each other like, you know, people would, hopefully, in Sydney or Brisbane or Adelaide or Perth. But you put this enormous, I don't mean you personally, but you put this enormous pressure on Muslims, Christians in Europe or the West or whatever. It's totally unnecessary.
It's not a great time to be heating up the old Huntington garbage about a clash of civilizations.
I'm glad you used the word garbage, Uncle Philip.
Mm. And, well, one of the things you make the point, let's now change gear a little. Iran has a clerical government again, mm-hmm. and so to all intents and purposes does Iraq. So this brings us to that wonderful spread of democracy, which isn't going quite how President Bush envisaged.
Not exactly, no. You see, it's only what, 2002, Bush said, what we need in Palestine are new leadership and new parties. Well, he sure got them. They weren't the leadership and the parties he wanted, though, you know. At the time, it was an anti-Arafat comment, of course. No, there's no doubt, look, that the Muslim world at the moment is producing Muslim governments for Muslim countries, whether it be a Shiite government in Iraq, which is what has actually happened, whether it be a more clerical Shiite government in Iran, which is what has happened, whether it be a more religious-orientated Muslim government in here in Lebanon, where the Hezbollah, which are regarded as terrorists by the United States, have a minister in the government here, in the government of the country which I live.
And, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt getting 20% of the seats.
Exactly, 20%. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And now we have Hamas. Now, there is a lesson here. There's a message somewhere there. You know, even if one is kind of bored and old or young or whatever, there's a message, and that is America's plans for this region are not going to work. People are, you know, I hate this phrase, turning to Islam. They were always Islamic. People are not turning to Islam. They were, oh, this is a Muslim area. There's a small Christian minority, which actually suffers considerable discrimination, which is another issue which you and I should talk about sometime. But nonetheless, this is a Muslim area of the world, and they are producing more and more Muslim, Islamist, religious governments as opposed to secular nationalist Arab governments. And, or at least, you know, percentage of seats in parliament. And we have to acknowledge this and say, look, hold on a second, there's a message here. We tell them they want democracy, and they say, yes, we'd like democracy, and we'd like these Islamists in power. And then we say, oh, this is terrible. What a terrible defeat for democracy and freedom. Hamas has taken power in Palestine. But they elected them. Hamas played a role. You know, we constantly demand that those who don't believe in democracy, quote-unquote, should use the ballot box. And when they use the ballot box and take power, we say it's the end of peace. It's ridiculous. The best thing, if Hamas is as popular as it is, which it obviously is, the best thing that could happen is it took part in elections. What a pity Islamic Jihad didn't take part in elections. But Hamas did.
Hmm.
You know, I remember back in 1990 in Algeria, they announced they were going to have true elections, and it suddenly became apparent that the FIS, the Islamic Salvation Front, Front Islamique de Salut, in French, was going to take power, and they cancelled the second round of elections because they didn't want an Islamic government. And all the European powers, we clapped our little hands in glee that they had cancelled the second round of democratic elections because the wrong people were going to be elected, you know. It's time we grew up and said, okay, look, the Palestinians want Hamas. The Iraqis, as a majority of the population, want to produce a government which is effectively Shiite. I'm sorry, it isn't very nice for us Westerners, but that's what they want. You know, can you imagine if a Muslim government or an Arab government suddenly said, we object very much to the election of Mr. Blair, we're against the Labour Party, or, you know, we really don't like Mr. Chirac as President of France, or we're against Republicans, we're on the side of the Democrats, they should cancel the elections in the United States, you know. I mean, it's extraordinary. But we don't do that. We'll never look through the other side of, you know, that phrase in the Bible, that wonderful phrase, through a glass darkly. We'll never look through the other side of the glass, will we?
Before I let you go, Bob, just one other question. How do you think the forthcoming Israeli elections are going to play out? Will the Sharon party do awfully well?
I don't know. You know, I've always taken the view internationally that whether it's a Labour government or a Likud government or now, you know, a new government, Sharon's new party, I don't think it makes a great deal of difference to the spreading of settlements, colonies in the West Bank and the continuation of the occupation of the West Bank. I don't know. I suspect we'll see our old friend Mr. Netanyahu get back. And since I love going to press conferences and trying to ask him horrible questions, there's a terrible journalistic thing in me that wants Netanyahu to be back as a Likud leader. But he might not be. I don't know. I can't give you a... My crystal ball is broken a long time ago.
Thank you very much, Robert Fiss, talking to us from Beirut. Robert is, of course, the Middle East correspondent for The Independent, and it's always splendid to have him on our little wireless program, LNL, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and downloadable via MP3 onto your pod.